Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. I don't love you anymore.
It's just a shiver. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. I'm on location, helping some people. One more week to go in a one-month protocol to help reverse a lot of conditions using just lifestyle behavior. At the end of this, I'll be inviting them on the air so you can hear their stories. Also today, we're going to begin by taking a look at some 100-year-olds living in an Italian village. From university in Rome, they took a look and said, how are these people doing it? I'll share that information. Also, vitamin D3 supplements shown to significantly improve autism symptoms. And that's from the Assiut University in Egypt. We also have a study on why men should not be sexist from Indiana University. I'll go through each of the things that happen if you are sexist and why it's bad for you, not just the person that you may be harassing. University of Georgia has a study on plant compounds. They can boost your brain function, especially the older you get, and a whole lot more on health and healing. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor William Robinson, and we're going to talk about our failing domestic economy, our growing debt, and the deep state. He is professor of sociology, University of California at Santa Barbara, and he is a scholar activist. He's also on the faculty of the Latin American Studies and in the Global and International Studies program. He's deeply involved in third world struggles for social justice and popular empowerment movements. And I'm going to talk with him about something that most people are not aware of. What percentage of Americans are in debt, how much they are in debt, and what are the consequences now that we have encouraged and supported, without legislation, poverty prisons again, where if you can't pay a bill, you can be arrested by a SWAT team and taken to a private judge and put into a private prison where you could possibly never get out. Well, isn't that against our Constitution? No, it's not. And everyone in government is fully aware of this, and all the policymaking positions, and all the people running for office. So how many of the politicians, except for Jill Stein, how many of the politicians, including Bernie Sanders, said we should close down all of these for-profit prisons, and we should empty out the existing prisons in America and only keep those who are an actual danger to society? None. Well, wonder why. We'll talk about it with him. And I have some new statistics about how bad the world is in its economy. And I'll also be talking about the money the Pentagon spends, wrongly spends, these boondoggles, and yet they're never held accountable. Wow. When you hear the amounts, it's staggering. Also, I want to address something that concerns me. California, the number one group of people fighting the fires in California, saving lives, saving homes, are paid $1 an hour to battle those wildfires. $1 an hour? Yeah. 1,900 inmates at a time are directly fighting fires alongside professional firefighters from the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. But once they get out of prison, they cannot go and apply for work as a firefighter. Why not? Well, after all, it's California, so contradictions in logic and reason, ethics and morality should not be a surprise, especially when you got a governor and legislators out there who are so utterly out of touch with truth. We'll discuss it. I do not know if I'll have time for this today, because this is a really strong guest, and I like to let my strong guest just run even till the end of the show. But if we do have time, I'm going to play I'm not going to start today because it's literally 30-some minutes on the big oil conquered the world, yes. But now they are literally controlling all of genetic engineering. That's not a good thing, because we like to think these are benevolent individuals and university professors all working kind of by themselves and coming up with ways to prevent disease. Nothing could be further from the truth. And this will be the most comprehensive, scholarly, in-depth, name the names, show their connections, group of people that have done more to harm us than any other group in American history. And they're in control now. So we're going to talk that out. But if I do have time, I'm going to do a talk back. And this talk back is about how the mainstream media admittedly is infested with child sex trafficking, all forms of casting couch sexual assaults. And anyone in Hollywood can tell you this. And by the way, I not only have friends who are producers, but a former employee of mine for 3 years, and told him when to go to California, and I gave him the $3,000. This was in the 1960s. And he became Hollywood's biggest manager and publicist for his whole career. And we stayed friends all this time, and he has a lot to say on this topic, and there's no one closer to it than him, because he's gone through at least 5 decades. So when I'm talking on this, I am talking not from hearsay, because I don't engage in gossip. So we're going to play a tape from a commentary. You can agree or disagree, in part or whole, but you'll have an opportunity to share your points of view on that. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 if you want to talk after we play that segment. That's assuming you have a chance to get to it. And if you are listening now and you're not always able to be at a land-based station, that's understandable, then I want you to be able to have two numbers. One, you can listen anywhere in Canada and the United States by telephone, noon to 1, Monday to Friday. Write this down, please. 424-203-8046. 424-203-8046. But 99% of the people now, almost 100%, listen to lives. The numbers are huge. To give you an idea, we had a person who used to work for one of the major networks, who was a phenomenal person, by the way, and who ran Progressive Radio Network, and a no-nonsense person who collected figures. And one day, she comes to my office, she said, "I just thought you'd like to see how many people have been downloading your show." "Okay, how many?" She said, "As of today, 54 million. Let me repeat that. 54 million people had downloaded the program from the archives. And that was 6 years ago. We're figuring it's 100 million today. So most people listen at night when it's convenient for them. You can too. If you're out and about traveling, want to listen, here's the archival number. 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. We always begin on health and healing. We now know from the University of Georgia that the same compounds that give plants and vegetables their vibrant colors are also able to bolster brain functioning as you age. The researchers from the Department of Psychology is the first to use MRI technology to investigate how levels of those compounds affect the brain activity, and showed the study participants were lower in levels. If they didn't have them, they had less brain power. But if they had more fruits and vegetables, especially the brighter colored ones, they had greater power to complete memory-oriented tasks. Now, you know these compounds, carotenoids, those are common, lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, xanthine. These have been shown in previous research to bolster eye health, cognitive health, especially as you get older. And what isn't known is the neuromechanisms underlying the relationship between these compounds and cognition. But they're there. So here's what we need to know. the more fruits and vegetables that you consume, the more darker colored ones like purple grapes or red cherries or strawberries, raspberries, or a purple plum or an orange, yellow lemon, rainbow colors, extremely good for your brain. Also, we now know that if we are using female hormone replacement therapy, you can end up with and this is synthetic female hormone replacement therapy. The newest study just confirms other studies. You're more likely to have heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancer, and dementia. So you could be starting this in your late 40s, early 50s, and it just speeds up your death process. So don't use them. Use natural bioidentical hormones. That's different. You get the benefit of turning off hot flashes, maximizing bone density to prevent osteoporosis, but you're not going to kill yourself in the process. For those of you adding fiber to your diet or having a healthy, fiber-rich diet, from the University of Michigan comes a study published in Cell, and they reported the findings of an international team of researchers, and they found there's a really good protective effect of fiber against the ability of pathogenic microorganisms to penetrate and infect the walls of the colon. And this is new. Now, we know that fiber helps in prebiotic. It helps create good bacteria. We knew it sweeps out debris. After all, when you have a bowel movement, what's actually there? Well, depends upon what you've eaten. But if you're eating healthy, you're getting undigested fibers, what we call lignocellulose. You're getting dead cells, because as the cell dies, the body has to remove it, and that's where it removes it. And you're also getting moisture, so that it can move, so it's not constipated and stuck. And you're getting bacteria. And in some cases, bacteria is one of the largest parts of that. Now, here's something a little aesthetically unpleasant, but we need to talk about this. People who have a lot of fiber in the diet, spaced throughout the day, apples, the skin of an apple is phenomenal, blueberries, terrific, legumes like beans and lentils, chickpeas, those are good. Nuts, walnuts, almonds, all the nuts, seeds, sunflower seeds, these all have their nutrition encapsulated in some form of protective exterior shell. So as the shell breaks down in the body, like you're eating a sunflower seed kernel, well, the outer part of that doesn't have the nutrition, but the inside does. So the outer part acts as the fiber, and it sweeps. All these are sweeping debris out of the body. Ideally, as you consume a meal, shortly thereafter, you should be vacating the remnants of the previous meal. That's an ideal digestion. But sit across from people who haven't had a regular movement in, let's say, every 2 days, every 3 days, that means that all that bacteria and all that dead cell material is backing up into the intestine. And it's really very unhealthy. So if you're a meat eater, if you're eating cheese and meat and sugar, you have putrefaction. And that putrefaction in the intestine is really bad. So the more sugar you have, the more odorous you become. And the bacteria, our deadly bacteria, are really bad. If you've ever been around someone who has an infection in the leg, for example, or gangrene, the smell is just overwhelming. It smells like dead flesh. Well, it's dead flesh. All bad bacteria. Now, bacteria will take on the scent based upon the sweat and what's in the sweat, and the same in the intestines. So clean up your diet. You clean up your body. You get the fiber in, you wash that whole intestine through. Juices clean the intestine and colon and the rectum. Green juices in particular are extremely beneficial, like wheatgrass or chlorella, spirulina. Those are terrific. Lemon with ginger, terrific. Apple cider vinegar, terrific. So those are the big, that's where you get your loaf of sponge and you really clean it out with a really good soap. And in effect, you want a clean intestine because if you don't have one, you're more susceptible to polyps, precancerous lesions, and colorectal cancer. And colorectal cancer is one of the deadliest cancers, and that's almost always due to a high-protein meat-based diet with sugars. And you don't need any of that. You can prevent that and be regular and have a really good digestion, no leaky gut, no candida, no yeast fermenting. So it's all possible. So that's the fiber, and that's what they were showing in that particular study. Also, there's a study from Arizona State University that showed that a good vegetarian diet does not in any way compromise athletic performance. For years, there were these myths that, oh, if I go on a vegetarian diet, I'm going to get weak. Not true. Look, we've had a Mr. Universe, a Mr. World, a Mr. America, all vegans. And how would you say your strength compares to a grayback gorilla? No American, no human's ever been that strong. Vegan. So understand, yeah, will chimpanzee eat a monkey if it can find one? Yeah. But they almost exclusively subsist on leaves and fruits and vegetables. So we can more than be a great athletes if we go on a healthy vegan diet. And finally, biologists explain how marijuana causes tumor cells to commit suicide. And this was done at a university in Spain. A molecular biologist from the university in Madrid, a Cristina Sanchez, has been studying the molecular activity of the cannabinoids for over 10 years. And through her studies, she and her colleagues have found that a THC, which is the main psychoactive part of cannabis, kills tumorous cells while allowing healthy cells to be. Don't affect them at all. And it was an unexpected discovery when Sanchez and crew were studying brain cancer cells to grasp a better understanding of how they function. And they observed that when cells were exposed to THC, that the tumoral cells stopped growing, then destroyed themselves. The cancer cells committed suicide. And this occurred both in lab tests and animal trials. And this was reported, by the way, back in 1998. And it was reported in a European biochemistry journal called FEBS Letters. Now, how many have come after that? Thousands. So let's just understand what we're dealing with. We have thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing that the cannabinoids can reverse cancer, stop cancer, including some of the worst cancers, lung cancer, can help with autism, can help with stop seizures, and yet we criminalize it. We put people in prison for using it. We actually, who was it? A country singer, I believe, just last week. I haven't read a newspaper. I haven't watched television in 2 months. First recovering from the hurricane, there was no electricity, let alone television. But now on retreat, there's no television, there's no newspaper. And so, but I was told that a country singer was arrested in Canada when they looked in her tour bus and found a little vial of the cannabinoid oil, the medical oil, and she was arrested for that. And you think, wow, what kind of police state is that? How stupid is that? And yet we have a lot of stupid. So let's not empower or enable the stupid legislators, the attorney general, the president, his entire cabinet, all of Washington, D.C. And they're such hypocrites because if you knew what went on each night in Washington, D.C., your head would explode. And yet these people, sanctimoniously and with self-righteousness, deem what is good for us. Well, save your hypocrisy, Washington. No one believes you. No one believes the media, the New York Times. because you have betrayed reason and honesty at every level. And this study was just the latest to show that. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Hey, you! Come out here on the floor. Let's rock some more. Come out of here on the floor. Honey, let's rock some more, yeah. Now when you get out here, don't you have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out.
Hi, everyone. We've got about 10 minutes before I go to my guest. And what I want to do now is I want to play a segment. This is for our talk back. It's not to agree or disagree with. It's to have your own opinion and decide whether or not there is legitimacy in anything being said or not. And then how you handle the problem. And the problem is the way that we exploit sex in our society. We exploit it in movies, in the media, of all types. But what happens when people like children are exploited? Now remember, we had Brad Pitt. We had the star of, I don't know his name, but the star of the Harry Potter, Potter movies come forward and talk about pedophilia. Both did. Then Mr. Kuncher came forward in a congressional hearing. And others have come forward. The guy, what's his name, Corey, I don't know his last name. He's come forward repeatedly, and nothing is done. People make a statement, nothing is done. As if this one soul, you know, movie mogul, Harvey Firestein, he's the only one. He's not. The entire culture is rampant, and it's hypocritical. So here's what someone has to say. Then after she says with Chastain, and it's titled, Mainstream media just admitted Hollywood infested with child sex trafficking, then pull it back a little further and ask, hasn't this been going on a long time with the fashion industry? Wasn't this going on all the time, forever, with the music industry? And now it's been going on since the beginning of Hollywood. By the way, I know it was going on because I was close personal friends with Gloria Swanson, the founder of Hollywood. She and Charlie Chaplin's Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Sr., Max Baer, they founded United Artists. Hedy Lamarr. A lot of very famous people from old Hollywood who I knew talked about it. And so what was going on then has never stopped. But now we're suddenly shocked. Shocked? Yeah. Yeah, we're shocked. Sure. So let's listen to this, and then you call in and you give us your thoughts about what are the solutions and what about the hypocrisy and what happens when we should be investigating this and the media knows about this and doesn't touch the story until suddenly there is a person that we can attack, like a Bill Cosby, but we won't attack a Bill Clinton. Why not? Had multiple charges of rape against him, and the only people who were attacked were his victims. Oh, yeah, his victims. What kind of hypocrisy is that? Shouldn't there be one standard for everyone? Let's now go to our guest who's standing by. My guest is Professor William Robinson. I gave you his background earlier in the program. And let's say hello to Professor William Robinson. Nice to have you with us today.
Good afternoon, Gary. Pleasure to be on your program again.
Most independent economists today agree that the U.S. still has not fully recovered from the recession. In fact, our debt bubbles are actually larger today than they were back in 2008, and there are more of them. So the big banks haven't learned, in my opinion, they haven't learned any lesson from the past because they control the Treasury Department, they control the Fed, they influence the 12 regional banks. There's no one going to demand that they shape up or their banks be taken over and deconstructed. So the big banks, they're in charge. And I believe you uncovered the global economy is dangling by a shoestring. Yet we have the White House and the GOP Congress pushing a tax bill that will inevitably increase all the problems we're facing already. Inequality, forcing citizens into greater credit card debt and various loans obligations they can't pay, and very likely large investment losses. People are going to lose their homes. Small business people close up their stores. And the most difficult thing is to understand is the fact that Wall Street and Washington are fully aware of these dismal figures and statistics. Where the economy is ultimately headed, and I am not aware of efforts being made to remedy it. The only great and real growth sector seems to be in the private military industrial complex. They're doing BOCO business. Their future is bright. And the 400,000 individual and corporate contractors, they're on a gravy train. I can't believe that any Wall Street executive or corporate CEO does not understand the implications of a $13 trillion household debt. And the only conclusion I can draw is that maybe some of this is not unintentional. But I can't prove that. All I can prove is people either very stupid running all this or they're very maniacal. And either way, I am not a supporter of disaster capitalism and its agenda, but those in this Oval Office in Washington are. So take your time, please, and give us your assessment about how we might first look at the economy as it really is and not how the talking heads on the networks and Wall Street Journal and Barron's and want to make us believe it is. And even today, the New York Times is reporting how Janet Yellen over at the Federal Reserve, how good things are because look how low our unemployment level is. And I said, when you have 96 million Americans who did work and could are not working, we don't have a 4.3% unemployment rate. We have a 22 to 23% unemployment rate. We can't even be honest about the foundational issues. Your thoughts, please.
Right. Well, the different aspects of this looming crisis that you mentioned, these weaknesses in the U.S. economy, are replicated at a global level. It's not just the U.S., but the entire global capitalist economy, which is dangling from a shoestring. I was motivated to write this article because the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which is involved in just about every country in the world, held their annual meeting in mid-October, just this past weekend in Washington, D.C., and they were elated that there's an over 3%, they're projecting an over 3% growth rate for 2017. But beyond that 3% figure, all of this data, some of which you mentioned there, are indicating that we're headed for another massive economic crisis, another great recession, or possibly another great depression. And I mean, one of the things going on here is that the structural conditions that led to the 2008 financial collapse have not been corrected. And in fact, as you were pointing out, they've gotten significantly worse. You mentioned, I mean, one of the reasons that there's this very light recovery since 2008 is because of debt spending. Consumers, and you mentioned the $13 billion figure, and this is the highest rate in recorded history, $13 billion, has now surpassed the level of consumer debt since the eve of the 2008 collapse. But that's just the United States. And of course, that debt spending through credit cards, through mortgages, through student loans and auto loans and so far, and has avoided another collapse since 2008. But that's global. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which brings together the richest, most developed countries around the world, recently issued a report that pointed out that the ratio of income to household debt remains historically high, never been higher, and it's significantly deteriorated since 2008. What that means is that people's income, household income, all around the world remains stagnant, and they're just staying afloat by more and more and more debt. So one thing that could trigger this next collapse is debt default. But it's not just private household debt defaults. It's also state. Right now, the global bond market has surpassed $100 trillion. That means that governments all around the world have to continue to borrow and borrow and borrow just to stay afloat. And as soon as they start defaulting, we move into another massive crisis. And then he's another figure. You know, this is all the global economy again, because, as I said, what you were saying about the U.S. economy is something going on at the global level. We talk about the real economy, which is the goods and the services that human beings produce all around the world. And we talk about the fictitious economy, which is this unbelievable amount of financial speculation. And here we can talk about the banks that you mentioned, but also the investor class all around the world, in and out of the banks. So the real economy worldwide is $75 trillion. Human beings produce total value of goods and services worldwide for $75 trillion. Yet just the global derivatives market, and the derivatives market is just one form of financial speculation that has nothing to do with the real economy. You also have collateralized debt obligations, et cetera, et cetera. Just derivatives market is an unbelievable $1.2 quadrillion. And yes, your listeners heard that right. The real economy in the world is $75 trillion. And just the derivatives market is $1.2 quadrillion. So there's this massive, unbelievable amount of speculation in the global casino. You link that together with public and private debt, and you have a recipe for a massive crisis here. So one other thing I want to mention, you know, we talk in political economy and in sociology of what's called an overaccumulation crisis, meaning that inequality, social inequality is so intense that the vast majority of people cannot absorb what the global economy puts out. And I know that your listeners are familiar with this figure. It's been widely discussed. Oxfam reports that 1% of humanity at this time owns over 50% of the world's wealth. But what is less mentioned, I mean, that's the billionaire class. What is less mentioned is at least analytically a more significant figure, and it is that 20% of humanity, this not even necessarily affluent, but at least you're consuming in that 20%, owns 95% of the world's wealth. That means that 80% of humanity has only 4.5% of the world's wealth. And so that 80% of humanity cannot consume. It means that the output of the global economy cannot actually be absorbed. That's what we call an overaccumulation crisis. The investor class, the billionaire class, the Wall Street banks, the corporations are awash in cash. They have unbelievable amounts of cash they've accumulated, but they can't reinvest it profitably anywhere because no one can consume. And that leads to what you pointed out, Gary, that there are two outlets. There have been two outlets that I want to emphasize. So where are they going to invest their capital and continue making profits to hold off or stave off a crisis and the next collapse? And one, of course, is the new, and I wrote this in the article that you mentioned, my most recent article, is the digital economy, this massive, massive bubble right now, stock market bubble, but especially in the tech companies that investors all over the world have been pouring billions and billions, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars into the digital sector, and it cannot possibly be sustained. So that's one way to stave off temporarily a crisis. Here's one figure to that. And then I'll turn to the second, which for me is the most alarming, which is expanding a global police state to stave off crisis. But the tech sector in 1970 got a barely $17 billion in investment. You fast forward to 1990, that's the eve of the mass introduction of the internet and the new digitalized economy, $175 billion. Now you fast forward to last year, $654 billion. So what this is that venture capitalists and bankers and investors around the world don't know what to do, where to park their money, and so they're parking it into the tech sector, and that is going to bust as well. So the final option that, let's say, or to use my own language, I call it the transnational capitalist class, this global investor class that moves all around the world. The final outlet they have to try to profitably invest their money, and in which case also save off a global collapse, is the global police state. And here you have the with that inequality that I mentioned, 20% owning 95.5% of the world's wealth, 1% owning 50% of the world's wealth, you have unbelievable social stability. You have this political need that the system has for social control and for repression on the one hand. And then you have the economic need, what I call the transnational capitalist class, to continue to make profit, accumulate their capital. And they've been pouring billions and billions and billions of dollars into global police state, into new systems of everything you could possibly imagine, into there's in fact new systems of warfare and repression. They've been made possible by more advanced level of digitalization, but they've been put into place by states who draw on the global investor class, the transnational capitalist class. And so you have now AI-powered automatic weaponry, you have unmanned attack and transportation vehicles, you have robot soldiers, you have a new generation of super drones, you have microwave guns now that immobilize, you have cyber attack and info warfare, biometric identification, state data mining, global electronic surveillance systems now that allow for tracking and control of every single movement and so forth and so on. So what, and by the way, all of these things are applied. There's a fusion of military application in traditional battlefields like Syria right now and civilian application to the cities of the world and to the, and to communities that are in struggle around the world. So you get this fusion of the systems, political need for social control and repression in the face of this unbelievable inequality and hardship, and the economic need that the system has to find some outlet for this surplus accumulated capital to avoid another economic collapse. And I mean, that's in very, very brief summary what I, you know, some, you know, what I wrote about in this latest article. I'll conclude with two things. You know, if you look, go back to the 1970s, it's important that we don't lose the historical perspective. There was this big structural crisis of capitalism in the 1970s, and then that launched the world on the path of neoliberal globalization. And that went for a couple decades. But then at the turn of the century, there was the dot-com bubble, and it burst, and there was a global recession in 1999, 2000, 2001. Of course, then the attacks of 2001 happened. But then the next big crisis was the bursting of the housing bubble and the 2008 Great Recession. So everything now indicates that that we are on the verge of another major collapse. And what we're going to see, and the reason in this article I mentioned the increasing digitalization of the global economy together with global police state, is we're going to see the cementing or the fusion of the new dimensions of the digital economy with this global police state, if there's no change of course. And, of course, that change of course needs to come from mass mobilization and popular struggle from below. But I wanted to make, just as an aside, you were mentioning massive and underemployment in the United States. There's one other point I wanted to make on following up on that, and it is that even when employment has been generated since 2008, the jobs that are being created do not resolve in the least bit this crisis of overaccumulation, because they are unstable, precarious, and poorly paid jobs. And here's another bit of data. This is U.S. government data, that 9.9 million jobs were created between 2005 and 2016, and 9.1 million were destroyed. And when you look at the data, almost exclusively the jobs that were created are precarious, lower paid, more precarious and unstable jobs than the jobs that were destroyed. So you're having this wholesale shift in the labor force participating in better paid jobs, jobs to these precarious part-time temp, outsourced, precariatized, flexibilized jobs. And so this job creation does absolutely, even if there is a creation of jobs, which is not, as you point out, it does absolutely nothing to aggravate these tendencies towards global crisis.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You said a great deal about our problems in almost an essay form. I want to pick up on two things that you had alluded to. One was, we are now in the biggest bubble in American history, what's called an equity bubble. This is not real. It's completely manufactured. Corporations are spending up to $1 trillion collectively or more buying back their own stock. And the reason they do this buyback is because it then increases the value of the outstanding stock, and therefore the more stock you sell, the more diluted the value of individual shares become. And that doesn't help raise the wages, improve the economy. It does not increase more inventory. It doesn't help anybody but the people running the corporations and their stockholders. Now, we're not looking at the other end of that. What happens when, historically, if you were a young African-American and you wanted to improve your chances in life, you would go to college, as millions have done. But now, I'm questioning, at least 50% of all students, you may not want to go to college at this time. You may want to put that energy without debt into other ways of mastering some skills before we see which direction this whole collapse is going to take. It's going to collapse from one side or the other. You don't want to be on the side that collapses. And frequently, if you had skills that you could barter in fair exchange or at least have a living wage from, better than going to school in a course that you're not going to be able to capitalize that in the marketplace. 55% of all students right now who graduate from college are living at home. They did okay in school, but that okay in that degree does not apply to getting a job, or even if it does, not one that they can repay their debt. This is the latest from Ben Miller, a Center for American Progress. Quote, 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Education provided the first ever look at long-term outcomes for student loan borrowers, including results by race and ethnicity. The data shows that 12 years after entering college, this is 12 years after entering college, the typical African-American student who started in the 2003 school year and took on debt for their undergraduate education owed more on their federal student loans than they originally borrowed. This holds true even of students who finished a baccalaureate degree at a public institution. And, well, hold on a second. If you've been paying back your debt every single month on time for 12 years and you still have more debt, all you've been paying is interest. Why does the U.S. government have to charge interest? Why do we allow – it's no different than if the United States government now became the new payday lender. First of all, it means you're creating debt peonage. Secondly, the new way that these debts are being collected is by SWAT teams. One specific example I reported on was a SWAT team broke down a door in a California home to go in there to arrest a person because she was late on a student loan, student debt. Now, it goes further. It says that over 50%, 75% borrowers defaulted, including 75% who dropped out for non-for-profit colleges. 50% of all African Americans couldn't pay their debt at all and defaulted. Hello, you cannot default on a debt. It's not forgiven. You may stop paying. But the interest now compounds. So look at how many millions of African Americans are now not able to pay it. The government has no legislation to forgive that debt. And as a result, you can come get arrested and go to debtor's prison. And that will be defended by the very police forces you say, like asset forfeiture. And they will get their money back any way they can. And your interests are not a part of any solution as we stand. Could you address that, please?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you raised a lot of things. Let me try and quickly address them in sort of a big picture. I mean, I have been saying for a while now, and some people think that this is an exaggeration, but in a literal sense, we are facing a mounting dictatorship of the transnational capitalist class. In a literal sense, that the transnational capitalist class, these global investors organized in the banks and the corporations and so forth, are dictating human beings' lives all around the planet and what's going on in our global civilization. And that dictatorship of the transnational capitalist class is exercised through states. And in this case, we're looking at the U.S. state or the U.S. government. You mentioned at the start, because it's going to be linked to students, the younger generation, African-American students, but all the younger generation, there's a set of bubbles. There's the asset bubble is one. There's the tech bubble is another. That's linked to the larger bubble you mentioned, the equity bubble and the mechanisms of buyout. And then there's this debt crisis. And you pointed out nightmarishly the criminalization of those who have gone into debt, including debt on student loans. But that means is that if students want to even try to survive in this new globalized capitalism, they have no choice but to seek a college education. And in order to do so, they have no choice but to get student loans. And so they're locked into control by capital and into control by the state if they don't pay back those loans. So this is a form. I mean, and it's not just that. I mean, there's a SWAT team, and that is shocking. But also, if you want to get a job now, there's a background check, and the background check makes sure that you're paying back your loans. So, I mean, you can't do anything. You can't get a job. You can't do anything without being locked into this debt bondage for the rest of your life. But, you know, I want to say something else as well. What we are seeing is that as you made reference to this as well, getting a college education, not only is it not a guarantee of the job of a decent job, a job which you can live by, but increasingly it's not only is it not a guarantee, but increasingly you won't get a job that you can live by. I mean, what we're seeing, first of all, and this has been demonstrated, is that what today requires a college education, one generation ago required a high school diploma. And jobs have become routine, as this is linked to what I was saying before, the digitalization of the global economy. Jobs are routine. There is a bifurcation of jobs. There are a tiny handful of high-skilled jobs that are high-paid and stable. And there's a mass of jobs that have been routinized and de-skilled and unskilled. And increasingly, and the data shows this, that college graduates, the majority of college graduates are now going into these unskilled and routine type jobs that have very little to do with their education and with all of the effort that they put into getting a higher education. I just finished reading a book by Martin Ford, Rise of the Robots, and one of the things he's showing there with a whole lot of data is that over the next few years, we're talking, it's already started, and it's going to accelerate over the next 10 to 15 years, there's going to be this massive new round of automation. And that new round of automation is going to eliminate a lot of the jobs, routine-type jobs, even though you need a college degree, that the young people going into and just graduating from college now are going to be going into. So this criminalization of social control, even of college graduates, through not and you know, is going to, this is the ugly face of the future.
I want to close out, even though some of our stations only take 55-minute show, we're staying on PRN for just one more answer from you. So I apologize to going a little over here. But in today's New York Times, there was a piece that we'd reported on almost 20 years ago, and that was that during the conflict in a particular country in Malaysia, there was a massive amount of killing that occurred. The lowest figure that they can come up with is 500,000. And we had experts on who talked about how we knew this. In fact, it was Henry Kissinger who was part of this. The New York Times, now that official records have been released showing this, are shocked. That there was a country that we were doing business with, that we had close economic and political ties with, that we would support this. Well, here's what the New York Times, who has all these resources, could have also discovered. The No-Gun Ree Massacre, 1950 in South Korea. U.S. soldiers and U.S. air killed between 300 and 500 men and women, children, without provocation. No one was held accountable. That's just one. Then we have a long history in Guatemala. In 1954, the CIA launched Operation PB Success to install the military dictatorship of Carlos Castillo Armas, the first in a series of U.S.-backed dictators who ruled Guatemala. And Guatemala subsequently plunged into a civil war that cost scores of thousands of lives and ended all democratic expression for decades. Mm-hmm. The United States and CIA supported that. Guatemala's genocide in 1982 and 83, supported and funded by Ronald Reagan. But U.S. started to train right-wing counterinsurgents back in 1966. And dictator José Ríos Montt, responsible for war crimes, was sentenced to 80 years, but was supported by the U.S. the entire time. Then we had the U.S. bombing of Cambodia from 1965 to 73, a secret bombing campaign, 500,000 killed. The My Lai Massacre, 1968, American soldiers killed 500 innocent, unarmed civilians, including men, women, and children. The CIA knew about it. The U.S. government did everything it could to minimize it. Then we had the CIA's Operation Phoenix in Vietnam, and a man named Shackley headed it. He would be the most powerful man in the CIA who was not director of the CIA. Nothing ever happened. He got the highest award for the CIA, and he's actually, there's a moniker emblem of him in CIA headquarters. Then you also have the Israeli occupations from the 1960s to the present against Palestinians, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and most recently in Gaza. U.S. has supported all that. The Operation Pillar of Defense of the 14th to 21st November 2012, Operation Protective Edge, July 8th to July 26th, 2014, the UN confirmed Israeli war crimes committed. We supported Israel. We blocked any effort to hold them accountable. From 1973 to 1990, we supported the Chilean dictator Pinochet. He murdered directly 3,200 people, but up to 80,000 people were forcibly interned and over 30,000 tortured. We supported that. 1975, the U.S. supported Indonesia's invasion of East Timor and subsequent massacres, which is this part of this. In the Philippines, in 1975 to 84, we supported the corrupt Marcos. Thousands of political opponents were murdered. Waco, Texas, 1993, 76 members of a peaceful Branch Davidian church died. And we knew that we were going to rush them into a fire because we intentionally had a tank that had explosive canisters that were highly flammable, and we had planes flying over with infrared. Were we listening to every word they were saying and watching where they were? So we knew that they had no way of getting out. We knew that they wanted to come out and surrender, and still Janet Reno and the Clintons backed that and then tried to cover up. But one of the worst of all is Rwanda in 1994. Nearly 900,000, principally Tutsis, died. But we not only did the Clintons not do anything, but every single action by people within the State Department and the head commander in Rwanda, the UN head commander, was told to step down every time he went to defend the Tutsis and stop massacres. He was told, and the U.S. ambassador at that time was behind this, as were the Clintons. They were made aware, as would later come out, of everything happening all the time. So the Clintons are responsible also for not stopping the genocide in Rwanda, the Bosnian War of 1995, Srebrenica massacre involving the genocidal killing of 8,372 Bosniaks, mainly boys and men. And then we could add in the first Annana massacre in Lebanon, 1996. Then we had the Darfur Sudan massacres, 1998. We had the current events in Yemen that we're supporting with militarization of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And, of course, that doesn't even touch upon what they could have mentioned, that the current massacre of Muslims in Myanmar, and also the largest Native American massacres in 1847, storming Pueblo and Taos, 1959, Round Valley settler massacre, over 1,000 Yuki Indians killed, in 1859, and 1863, the River Bear massacre, United States Army Regiment killed 282 Shoshone men and women. I have about 100 more. So somehow, please save your shock and shock, New York Times, when I could give you a list that could fill a phone book of the United States being complicit, active, and covertly active in the innocent slaughter, innocents being slaughtered before the U.S. hand was firmly. Please.
Yes. And you could go on and on. You could fill a phone book. You barely, looked around the world and scratched on the surface of a few of these historical events and activities. I mean, I think there's two points to conclude on. One is that, the U.S. state is United States is really the key state in the global system that we lived in, at least throughout the 20th century and into the first part of the 21st century, the key state which is propping up this system, which is characterized by extreme injustice, extreme inequality, and systems of mass repression and control and warfare to contain that explosive inequality and explosive injustice. So that's the role of the U.S. state as the hegemonic state in this global system, to prop that system up, to make the world safe for transnational corporate plunder, for access to natural resources, markets, and labor pools on the part, of U.S. investors, but from investors around the world. And everything you've ran through, all of that can be tied to how do you make these regions, these countries, safe for this transnational corporate plunder? How do you put in governments which will facilitate that? And how do you remove governments and peoples and popular and mass movements that will get in the way of that transnational corporate plunder? That's the first point to conclude with. But the other one is the cultural and particularly the ideological dimensions of this. How do you justify that to the world's people when the world's supposed to be based on freedom and democracy? Unless you have this, U.S. foreign policy as pursuing freedom and democracy and security is nothing but an ideological smokescreen. And in that ideological smokescreen, the mass media plays a major role. You know, you're citing the New York Times there. Look at the coverage. I've been traveling for the last 3 days, so I've only glanced at the headlines, but every time I glance at a headline from the mainstream television news and newspapers, they're railing on and on about who Trump did or did not call with what this or that soldier that was killed and didn't call, and if Obama did or didn't call, and the scandal that Trump said Obama didn't make these phone calls. And I had not seen one word about Yemen, which you mentioned, by the way, the slaughter going on in Yemen. But also, there's a cholera epidemic, which is the worst cholera epidemic in history. 1 million people are becoming infected with cholera, 600,000 children. Not a word in the news, and yet there's this scandal about Trump said Obama didn't call U.S. soldiers. So that's the deep, also ideological dimension to legitimating or to simply covering up this what you've just run through.
Well, thank you for being on once again, Professor William Robinson. We look forward to your next discussion with us.
My pleasure always, Gary. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Gary Nall. Sorry for going a little over today, but I just felt that in the context of the political marksmanship that we see, we're not looking at the larger pictures. Have a nice day, everyone. Stay tuned. Utrice Lee coming right at it.